According to national statistics, the United States experiences more than 500,000 missing persons reported to authorities each year. And while many of those cases can be attributed to societal conflicts and influences, such as abductions, murders, and runaways, perhaps one of the stranger causes stems from disappearances in the wilderness, specifically by hikers, trail runners, and campers. People regularly flock to nature seeking peace of mind, an abundance of outdoor activities, and an escape from the hustle and bustle of our stressful everyday lives. Sometimes we're just looking for fun, and other times we have some type of achievement in mind, but regardless of intention, America's plethora of mountain ranges and national forests poses inherent risks and danger for those who brave them. While society is not indifferent to our plight for survival, and help is quite often right around the corner, the reality of venturing out into nature is quite different in contrast. Nature, as opposed to civilized society, is indifferent to our plight to survive, and it's simply because civilization is an evolutionary product derived from overcoming the apathy of nature. At home, you can stay indoors in your heated or air-conditioned house, and there's a multitude of options for what you can eat or drink, as well as shelter from both the elements and predators. Police and rescue operations are no more than a phone call away, and modern conveniences like smartphones, TVs, and computers prevent us from the necessity of going out into the wild to obtain better resources. So society has made life easier, but the fallout from leaving behind our less developed past is that, when we do head back into nature, we often forge ahead with a greater sense of unpreparedness. Society has given us the confidence to believe we can solve problems related to survival through an ability to overcome and adapt. So when we indulge nature, we often do so at the peril of an ignorance that dictates we'll find ourselves unprepared in some way. Each year, we hear about missing hikers and others who sought adventure in nature but failed to live to tell about it. They experience injury and death by way of everything from falls and animal attacks to exposure and dehydration or starvation, much of it stemming from a single concept: getting lost. Nature has a way of swallowing people, so that even when we know where they were and search high and low, they've vanished. It seems inexplicable, as though there should be some trace of their existence, yet it's common for nothing of the sort to ever be found. It's as though they disappeared into a void of darkness and silence, one in which the secret will remain forever, hidden among the silence and indifference. Nature is designed to hold its tongue because our evolutionary plight demands increasingly greater degrees of detection and integrity. It wants us to answer two things: what is the truth, and how can you prove it? That's where the two elements of identity arise as the abbreviation ID. One element is integrity, or I, and the other is detection, or D. When you combine the answer of what happened with the proof that it actually occurred in that manner, you answer the question of identity. Of course, that stems from the ultimate question of identity, which is, who created this universe, or, in a religious context, who is God? And once we have fully evolved to our greatest extent and are able to trace our steps back through that timeline to the beginning of our universe, we'll ID him. And that is the point of disappearances existing within the framework of our everyday lives. Likewise, when someone disappears within our evolutionary pathway, meaning a person, we follow the same protocol. We follow the clues to the greatest extent of information or clarity that we can garner, and then sort through those clues in a manner that takes us back to the beginning when it all started. It happens that way so that, along with unveiling the identity of the entity or person responsible, having a beginning and end tells us why. Who are they, and why did they create this mysterious universe? That's what a killer does, even if the guilty party is nature itself, and not a person. A mystery is created in which learning how it began and ended gives us a story that answers not only what happened and who did it, but why. In its most basic structure and function, that's the purpose of history, or his story. It tells us who created this mysterious universe and why. But if we don't have the means to answer those questions, then we must continue to evolve to have greater means of detection and integrity at our disposal. If we aren't able to accommodate that, of course, the mystery will remain unsolved. Such is the case of Barbara Bullock. Barbara Bullock made a difficult move from the East Coast with her husband Carl in 2001, where they settled in Corvallis, Montana, so that Carl could return to the region where he'd been raised. Carl had spent the better part of two decades in the Air Force before joining J.P. Morgan Chase Bank and having a successful career that culminated in the title of Assistant Director of Security Operations before he chose to retire. Barbara was initially hesitant about the cross-country move, especially to a place like Montana that was quite rural in relation to their old stomping grounds in New Jersey and New York, but she soon fell in love with the abundant nature and beauty that surrounded them. With a desire to explore these areas, Barbara became a frequent and enthusiastic hiker and runner, traversing trails all over the area, which left her in great shape. By 2007, however, when Barbara was 55 and Carl about 66, Carl had suffered a heart attack that limited his ability to join his wife on these adventures. Nonetheless, Barbara continued to venture into the wilderness and was known to carry a .357 Magnum revolver as a means of protection against predators of any kind. In mid-July 2007, Barbara and Carl hosted Carl's cousin Donna and her boyfriend, a 58-year-old man named Jim, who they had reportedly not met in person prior to this time. The visiting couple came from out of town by way of a rental car and were eager to explore the area. On the evening of July 17, 2007, the four of them had dinner and drinks at the Bullock home and made plans for Barbara, Donna, and Jim to go hiking the next morning. Unfortunately, due to his heart attack, Carl wouldn't be able to join them. Barbara was intent upon showing the visitors the view from Bear Creek Overlook in the Bitterroot Mountains, and it was accessible by way of a moderately difficult hike of 2.6 miles each way. The trailhead was located about 10 miles from their home, and without the nuisance of city traffic to interfere, it only took about 10 to 15 minutes to complete the drive up there. The next morning, however, Donna woke up feeling hungover from the drinks the night before and declined the invitation to join the hike, which left Barbara and Jim agreeing to proceed with the plan while Carl and Donna stayed back at the home. Carl had often taken the opportunity to get dinner started when his wife would go on long hikes, which gave them the opportunity to reconnect when she arrived home. So Carl and Donna were going to attend to the activities slated for later in the day, and in the meantime, Jim and Barbara hopped in Jim's rental car and headed out. Upon arriving to the location of the trailhead, it became apparent that the road was closed due to construction, but the crew had not yet arrived that morning. According to Jim, there was only one other car parked in the area by the trailhead that day, which was a white Chevy Blazer. The Blazer was a once popular SUV that was discontinued from production in 2005, but would still have been seen quite a bit on the roads back then. So, Jim and Barbara hiked the 2.6 miles from the trailhead to the culmination of that trail, which is the scenic Bear Creek Overlook. Jim says it was there that they stopped to take in the view and eat, at which point they intersected with two friendly young men who seemed to be in their early 20s. While no specific race is mentioned for either person, one was described as having light or pale skin with reddish hair, while the other had darker skin and hair. They were, of course, also described as being somewhat athletic. The men were reportedly accompanied by a black dog with white markings, which, based on the description, seems to have been a border collie. Accounts of this story vary by source, with some saying this was a short interaction and others claiming the conversation lasted about a half hour. For all intents and purposes, it appears to have been a friendly encounter with an amicable parting. Jim did not report any grievance between the two parties or that the young men seemed to have suspicious intentions. Either way, the two young men departed first, heading back down the trail toward the road by the trailhead with the dog. By this time, the construction crew had arrived and confirmed that the two young men and the dog descended from the trail before engaging the crew in a quick conversation that ended with the pair getting into the Chevy Blazer and driving away. The crew didn't notice much about the vehicle other than the fact it had a Montana license plate. Meanwhile, up on the trail at the overlook, Jim and Barbara finish eating and taking in the scenic view, at which point they decide to head back. This is where the mystery begins, at least in the manner that Jim tells the story. He says they initially walked together away from the overlook, but that he suddenly decided he wanted to turn around and get one last look at the breathtaking view, which left Barbara continuing to walk ahead of him. When he last saw her, he says she was 20 to 30 feet ahead of him, which is a very short distance. Accounts of how long Jim continued to take in the view vary slightly, but they all present it as less than 1 minute and very likely somewhere between 30 to 45 seconds. Of course, a person who is walking can't travel very far in that time, even if doing it at a brisk pace. And with a head start of only 20 to 30 feet, one would think that the other person would still be in view. But Barbara Bullock had vanished. Barbara has hiked this trail on many occasions and is quite familiar with the terrain. According to local law enforcement, this is an up-and-back trail, meaning it doesn't intersect in a maze of other trails and is pretty straightforward in terms of going to the top to the overlook and back. Jim says he saw nothing and heard nothing, and that when he had turned back to the trail after taking in the scenic view one last time, Barbara was nowhere to be found. Since that time, no trace of her has ever been discovered, not even her backpack or a shred of clothing. She simply vanished. Now, a simple conclusion would be one in which Barbara fell over the edge of the overlook or even descended into some other type of void, such as a crevice or a cavern, yet searches of the immediate area revealed nothing of the sort. Carl stated that Barbara was afraid of heights and never would have gone too close to the edge where a fall would occur, but respectfully, I find that assertion a little silly because Barbara was in the process of logging flight hours as a pilot to get her license. If you're scared of heights, the cockpit of a small plane is perhaps the worst place you could ever be. Anyhow, I think this is a moot point, however, because Jim claims that Barbara had already walked away from the overlook and was back onto the trail. He was closer to the edge in that case, so if she fell, it would have happened in his view and in a situation in which she was in front of him, not behind. Searches from both the ground and the air revealed no evidence of Barbara falling. Jim says he didn't hear anything that would indicate Barbara was grabbed by either a person or an animal. Law enforcement stated that the area on and around the trail was covered by loose shale, and therefore it would be easy to hear both the footsteps of both Barbara and a perpetrator, whether it was an animal or a person, if she had been abducted in that location. Jim reports no screams or cries for help, or any sounds that indicated Barbara had an accident or had been abducted by a predator. She was armed with a gun, of course, but it clearly had not been discharged, so if she was accosted, it's something that was spontaneous and with enough force that she was prevented from utilizing the weapon. Likewise, if she fell into something or off something, was still alive and capable, though injured, she could have discharged the weapon to indicate her position. She didn't. At this point, Jim searches for Barbara, but can't seem to find her, so he goes back down the trail to the trailhead and engages the construction crew. He describes Barbara, and the crew responds that they haven't seen her. We're not sure which party mentions the two young men in the blazer first, whether it was Jim or the road crew, but the crew acknowledges that they did see and speak to two young men with a black dog who got into the white Chevy Blazer and drove away. The men were friendly and did not seem suspicious, nor were they accompanied by Barbara Bullock. Despite a great deal of effort, those men and their vehicle have not been identified to this day. All we know for sure is they didn't leave with Barbara. At this time, Jim's car is the only non-construction vehicle at the parking location. Neither he nor the construction crew witnessed any other vehicles there. Again, let's remember the construction crew had not yet arrived to the job when Jim and Barbara reportedly started that morning, so there was no way to verify when Jim's rental car and the Blazer arrived. This is when Jim asks to borrow a cell phone from somebody on the road crew and calls the police. Of course, this is an intriguing aspect of the case, as cell phones were very common by this point in 2007. The first iPhone was even released that year, and so most people were already using cell phones, even if not smartphones, and had been for a long time. It would have been strange for an adult to not have a cell phone in 2007. Why doesn't Jim have one? And we have to ask if Barbara had one. I actually haven't seen that concern addressed in any coverage of this case. However, it seems that if Jim was able to borrow a phone from a local construction worker and call the police, then there truly was cell phone coverage in the area provided by local towers. So, I don't know if Barbara had a phone, and I'd also have to wonder if the police inquired as to whether Jim actually had one registered to himself. Did he have one, and choose not to use it under the guise of not having it? I really don't know. Either way, law enforcement is made aware of the disappearance and responds. Carl and Donna, who are waiting back at the house, are also notified, and Carl comes to search for his wife. Carl will actually go up there and search until midnight, at which point he's advised to pack it in because of the dangers brought on by darkness, fatigue, and his fragile health. What we can say, though, is that nobody finds any type of clue to indicate that Barbara is up there, or even near there. There are simply no leads. In the coming days, law enforcement will conduct both aerial and ground searches, scouring the area of the trail and the surrounding wilderness, which also reveals nothing in the way of a conclusive answer as to what happened to Barbara. Beyond that, the trail itself yields no evidence of Barbara having recently walked on it, as they aren't able to substantiate any of the shoe prints as being hers. A few days later, they bring in dogs to attempt to follow Barbara's scent, but there are no hits from the animals, not even in the places along the trail where Jim claims that she walked. So to the best of our knowledge, Barbara vanished when Jim turned around. Now, let's ask how that could happen. One popular theory is that Barbara was attacked by an animal, which in this terrain could possibly be a bear, but more likely a mountain lion. While assaults on humans by these animals are rare, they do occur, so let's take a look at the possibilities. There are a lot of black bears in that region, yet black bears tend to be smaller in size and less likely to have the ability to descend upon large prey in a way that both they and the prey remain silent during an altercation. Black bears are generally about 2 to 3 feet tall at the shoulders, weighing between 100 to 400 pounds, and are between 5 to 6 feet long. In coastal areas, black bears often have access to more food, and so they grow even larger. However, while bears do often target the neck of their prey, they also tend to maul prey and tear at limbs with brute strength to debilitate the animal. While an attack by a black bear is very unlikely to be something that occurs in silence after the point of engagement, it's also incredibly rare to be attacked by them in the first place. Statistics suggest that only approximately one person is killed by a black bear on the North American continent each year. Grizzly bears also inhabit this region, though not in abundance. Grizzlies are much larger than black bears, standing about 3.5 to 4.5 feet at the shoulder and weighing anywhere between 400 to 600 pounds. Again, concerning bears living in coastal regions, they even exceed 800 pounds. A male grizzly standing on its hind legs has the potential to be in excess of 8 feet tall, making them formidable predators. Yet, grizzlies only account for approximately 2 to 3 deaths per year in North America. Like black bears, they tend to avoid human contact, and attacks that do occur are normally defensive in nature and not predatory, such as the threat to cubs or during mating season. Now, on top of that, the average adult human walks about 3 miles per hour, which means that if Jim had his back turned to Barbara for 1 minute and she was already 20 to 30 feet ahead of him, then when he turned back in her direction, she would be between 284 to 294 feet ahead of him, which is less than the length of an American football field. Of course, the time Jim suggests is actually less than a minute, so we might assume Barbara is perhaps no more than 200 feet away at the point he turns back to her. More on that in a minute, but for now, in terms of animal attacks, perhaps the most likely occurrence would be an attack by a mountain lion. While they are fierce predators, they tend to be much smaller than bears, yet still attack large prey, which means they have to maximize the effect of the initial assault. For this reason, mountain lions rely on stealth, often moving in near silence and also seeking high ground from above their prey to pounce. Most males max out at about 180 pounds, however, and for that reason, mountain lions are generally predisposed to targeting the neck. From above, they're more likely to bite and clamp the spine by way of the nape of the neck on their prey, yet if involved in a struggle in which the throat is more accessible, they will target that area for the same purpose. Debilitating prey allows them to avoid injury, conserve energy, and more importantly, drag their large prey off to a place where they can conceal it from other interested predators and scavengers who would steal it. Bears do the same thing, and it happens because large prey are not often consumed at once. They return to it, and so concealment becomes the optimal method of preventing other animals from finding it. Of course, this isn't an exact science, as bears and mountain lions can only do so much in an effort to conceal the dead. It's not like they have a shovel and go 6 feet deep. They generally use the cover of large rocks and brush for concealment. So yes, both animals are capable of attacking in virtual silence and also carrying off large prey, but they don't make stealth a high priority in terms of sound after the point of attack. The approach often needs to be stealthy, even silent, but after that time, if they have something in their clutches and get involved in a struggle, it can get very noisy depending on the situation. And here, there's no indication of Barbara struggling with a large predator, both in terms of noise and blood or tissue being left behind in the aftermath. So while an animal attack is definitely a possibility, it's apparently rare, and there is simply no evidence here to suggest that's what really happened. And on the subject of large predators, if Barbara had been accosted by another human on the trail, that incident also created no noise or physical evidence, not even her shoe prints or scent being left behind afterward. There were also no drag marks. The only other people noted to be on the trail that day were the two young men with the dog who drove the Blazer, but they didn't leave with her, and so if they did something to her, her body and scent would be up there. Of course, if there was someone else up there, it's apparent that person had not come in a vehicle, which again would result in physical evidence such as a body, clothing, or even just her scent being detected during extensive searches. None of these things happened. So I think it's prudent here to establish that Barbara was actually on the trail that day before committing to her having disappeared from it. The only witnesses to her being there are Jim and the two young men with the dog, but the police were never able to find those men, even to this day, though it seems they actually did exist. Therefore, Jim becomes the only verified witness to Barbara being on the trail. However, the story he tells us is not consistent with the result here. Yes, search dogs tracking a scent make mistakes. And yes, sometimes aerial and ground searches fail to find the needle in a haystack of a human body in a mountainous region. The infrared technology attempting to locate Barbara's body heat also failed to discover her in the event she was still alive and perhaps injured. Would we expect to still have her shoe prints on the trail? Probably. Would we expect to recover something that belonged to her? Probably. But none of these things are certain beyond speculation. So let's take a moment to indulge the psychological aspects of this event. First off, with Jim being Barbara's guest on a trail he's never hiked before, does it seem likely she'd keep walking ahead of him and creating a gap between the two? That seems far more competitive than hospitable to me. One would think she'd stop and allow him that final look back at the scenery. And yet, the way he explains it, she was already 20 to 30 feet ahead of him. Why? Why would she be attempting to create a gap between herself and her guest? Again, it seems rude in the context of hospitality. She's hosting him in this situation and not racing the man. So consider this. If Jim tells us that they were walking together and he stopped to look back, you'd immediately think she'd see that, allow him that last look, and also stop, as it's the polite thing to do in this situation for a person who has never been on the trail. Yet if he puts her 20 to 30 feet ahead of him already, how does that circumstance change? Well, if she's ahead of him, and they're facing and walking the same way, when he stops and turns around, she won't be able to see him doing it. And of course, in her ignorance, we'll keep going. So to me, this seems like it could potentially be a manufactured circumstance. She's not only walking ahead of him, but clearly this situation also suggests that they aren't engaging in conversation as she'd realize he was falling behind, and he'd realize the moment communication stopped when something happened to her. However, he has them walking apart from each other and doing so in silence, with Jim not caring about how far his host has gone ahead of him and Barbara not caring about her guest falling behind her pace. When you pull back from the details and look at the larger theme of his assertion, it almost seems as though he's painting a picture of her trying to get away from him. She's pulling away, and then suddenly she disappears. Psychologically, it says something. Why would Jim be projecting a circumstance in which Barbara was pulling away from him, trying to create space between the two, and then she suddenly disappeared, never to be seen again? Well, let's go deeper into the thematic elements of that appearance and look at the walk in totality. What is Jim telling us about this journey when painted in broad strokes? He's saying that Barbara was with him on the way out, but not the way back. She disappeared after the two of them stopped, specifically right after she attempted to create space between them and head back the other way. Now, as there is simply no evidence Barbara was on the trail that day, we have to identify the origin of this projection. He seems to be extracting that circumstance of Barbara trying to get away from him by creating space and in an effort to go back the way they came, at which point she disappeared. So we ask ourselves, if Barbara never made it to the trail and disappeared beforehand, when was the last time these two were together alone on a journey? The answer is in the car on the ride there. Both Carl and Donna can verify they left together in Jim's rental car to head to the trail, and even Jim confirms that they took that drive alone. So what might have happened inside the car on the way there that caused them to stop, at which point Barbara tried to create space between the two, turn around, and go back, leading to her disappearance? Well, we can't answer that with any degree of certainty, as we're speculating, but as I said earlier, now that we've examined the story to its culmination, we have to work back through it to the beginning in order to have a better understanding of the emotional force driving its evolution. Apparently, at some point after Barbara's disappearance, Carl cut off contact with both Donna and Jim due to suspicions about Jim's potential involvement in the disappearance, specifically in the context of a crime. In turn, Donna supposedly told Carl that many of their family members believed Barbara had disappeared in order to commit suicide. Now, do people do that? Yes, but this assertion is ridiculous. Barbara was an avid hiker who would have countless opportunities to disappear forever without any type of scrutiny, but we're expected to believe she picks the one day where she has a guest with her as the day she's going to do it? As we can see, the police were called, and the family too. Everybody was searching for her, even to the point of infrared, search dogs, and Homeland Security. If you wanted to commit suicide and not be found due to the shame of your choice and/or desire to not hurt your loved ones, this would absolutely be the most difficult way of accomplishing that goal. So, here are a few simple facts. There is nobody other than Jim who has confirmed Barbara making it to the trail that day. The last person to see Barbara before her disappearance was Jim, even by his own account. When Barbara disappeared, she and Jim were not in the presence of others. It doesn't prove anything factually, but speaks volumes to the likelihood of what occurred here. Let's state that psychological narrative again, in terms of it being a projection. Barbara was with Jim on the way out, but then something happened that caused her to turn back the other way, a situation in which she was ahead of him and he was following, and they were no longer talking. Then she literally disappeared forever. At that point, he returned home without her. And then we'll reiterate the overarching theme of the journey. Barbara was with Jim on the way out, but not on the way back. She had disappeared. Now, we'll state again that no evidence of her being on the trail exists. So if Jim is projecting those actions onto their walk on the trail, and we know they had to happen prior, when was the last and only time they were alone on a journey with a destination but didn't come back together that way? The answer is in the car on the drive to the trail. So what happened? Well, we can't know for sure, but I'll tell you what I think occurred here. Let's go back to the beginning of the story, at least in terms of the things that are relevant to this day. We ask, how did Jim and Barbara end up alone? And here I'm just going to offer some ideas to get you thinking and have you formulate your own opinion, but at the same time, we're just going to open our minds to what might have occurred here by looking deeply into the psychology. So, the night prior to the hike, both couples, Jim and Donna and Carl and Barbara, gather at the Bullock residence for dinner and drinks. They're all relaxed and having a good time. Now let's look at this celebration from a relationship standpoint. A large part of our social interactions is defined by specificity of relationships, and the reason is that identity plays a huge role in the process of attraction and validation, whether we're talking about attraction from the standpoint of sexuality, status, romance, etc. So for instance, let's say you go on a first date. What's the goal? Getting to know each other, right? That's the primary goal of initial contact, and it happens because identity is the basis for the formation of relationships. And so, even in terms of friendship, we strive to get to know who the other person is on the inside, apart from physical appearances, because we ultimately want to find the places of similarity where we can connect emotionally with them. So the pursuit of understanding identity is the impetus for developing relationships, whether romantic or platonic. And the reason we do that is because we are attracted to that which is familiar. Neuroscience has proven that familiarity breeds a strong sense of attraction within us. But why is that? The answer is that familiarity is strongly correlated to the foremost principle that guides us in our pursuit of survival, which is safety. Familiarity leads to feelings of trust, which in turn generates feelings of safety. And when we feel safe, we feel certainty and thus attraction. It's well known that heterosexual women generally find themselves highly attracted to masculine traits that either exude safety, certainty, and predictability, or conversely, allow them the opportunity to foster that in a person lacking those traits but possessing the physical presence they desire. The first one is marriage material, while the second one is the bad boy stereotype. Those two categories of men are overwhelmingly considered more attractive than any middle-of-the-road counterpart, as it allows women the ability to take on well-defined roles involving their feminine energy. You are either becoming the wife, or the symbolic mother, who will raise a bad boy to a man by changing him and allowing his masculine physical presence to finally be complemented by his emotional maturity. For these reasons, humans have historically been tribal in nature, to a greater or lesser extent. Simply put, we stick to our own, though that's now changing by way of technological advances that have closed the gap on socioeconomic, geographic, and genetic considerations. We are no longer separated and isolated by distance and language barriers in a virtual world due to technological advances, and so we can build feelings of familiarity and safety with others who were previously completely unfamiliar to us by connecting with them online and through calls, text messages, and so on. Human nature remains the same, but interactions have evolved in terms of the quickly growing capacity to familiarize ourselves with outsiders. It's truly global in scale now. Yet it didn't start that way. In the beginning, and for a long time after, we stayed within the tribe, the village, and its traditions, and didn't dare leave. And so, that notion not only gave birth to the idea of being distrustful toward outsiders, but has become the driving force behind outsiders trying to find a way in by establishing relationships. And those relationships, of course, are all based in identity. Who are you? So when we meet new people, our interactions are geared toward finding a way in, so to speak, a way to get inside and prove we are one of them. We actually call this process finding common ground because it had its origins in a physical meeting place between two worlds or tribes in which people would meet and attempt to ascertain the identity of the other side as a way of establishing relationships. We know other people in relation to what they are to us. Mother, sister, lover, brother, coworker, enemy, friend. Yet upon our initial meeting, we are hesitant, distrustful, and even shy because we're still at the point of seeking that commonality in ignorance. So one of the easiest ways to break this invisible emotional barrier and get inside as an outsider is to already have a relationship with someone the other party trusts. For instance, which of these sounds safer? Going on a blind date with a stranger or going on a date with your best friend's sibling? It's clearly more comforting to explore the situation in which the person you are engaging already has a relationship with one of your own, so to speak. It makes you feel safer, more certain, and able to trust the person. But as it goes with any evolutionary principle, there's always a dark side, or irony, that these ideals bring to the table. As familiarity leads to strong attraction, it also means that we are more often attracted to people with whom we already have established relationships. So even if we are involved in a monogamous relationship, we are still predisposed to feeling safety and security and even trust when it comes to others in our inner circle. When we employ reason and logic to social interactions, we are shocked and appalled by the fact that so many people are betrayed by a friend or family member who cheats with their spouse or significant other. It's a nearly unconscionable betrayal. Yet on an evolutionary level, it's basically an inevitable result sometimes. We see those people closest to us as safe, secure, and capable of being trusted. Yet social contracts like marriages and committed relationships still can't dictate the nature of human attraction. We often cross those invisible borders of identity by way of relationships because they're genetically irrelevant to our plight to survive and thrive. They're social constructs born of pretense and are not genetically binding in a context of survival. So, as many times as we might commit to one person romantically, we always have the option to go find somebody else, right or wrong. It happens because traditionally, survival was very difficult, and in a violent world dominated by predator versus prey, it was often necessary to find someone new due to factors like death and warfare, disease, and related considerations. All of which is to say that simmering underneath the pretentious niceties afforded by civilized society is a harrowing truth that we are still just animals seeking to survive any way we can and pass on our genetic legacy. And for that reason, we still struggle with ideals such as loyalty and commitment, leading us to the reality that we are all just struggling to find a way inside. Of course, for men seeking women, that can take on a literal meaning. And so when we discuss the concept of flirting, we understand that the most essential and common aspect of flirting is the process of teasing. And what is specifically being teased is either the ability or inability to get inside, or conversely, be allowed inside. Flirting is a gateway to love. Flirting is the equivalent of arriving on someone's doorstep, knocking, and having that person answer the door. A man might want to be let inside, but just because a woman has opened the door and presented the possibility that he might get inside doesn't necessarily mean it is going to happen. Flirting is simply a statement of intention, and conversely, acknowledgement of the intention, leading to a tense standoff in which it isn't yet clear if the man will be left outside or allowed to come inside. Sometimes that door gets shut in your face, even in situations in which you were sure it wouldn't be, and it happens because flirting is just an acknowledgement of intention and not actually the permission to enter. Now that we've detailed this process, let's apply it to the night before Barbara's disappearance. Let's ask about relationships. Which two people in the group have the relationship that is least defined by way of identity? Well, Carl and Donna are cousins, giving them a strong definition. Barbara is Carl's wife, and Carl is Barbara's husband. Jim is Donna's boyfriend, and Donna is Jim's girlfriend. These relationships are all either direct, such as Barbara being Carl's wife, or secondary, such as Donna being her husband's cousin. Yet the furthest removed relationship in the room, so to speak, is the one between Jim and Barbara. To Jim, Barbara is his girlfriend's cousin's wife, and to Barbara, Jim is her husband's cousin's boyfriend. So clearly, it is the least defined and most removed relationship in the room, and therefore the one that dictates the greatest necessity to get inside and find connection. Now, this doesn't start as something sexual. It starts as something exploratory. You feel removed from a defined relationship with this person and seek to close the gap, which is done by way of finding commonality. You do this because not knowing someone allows the ignorance to form feelings of distrust, lack of safety, and uncertainty. So you inquire about likes and dislikes and look for places where there's a match between your interests and the other person's. Let's say Barbara mentions that she enjoys hiking, and so does Jim. He might tell her. And in turn, Barbara, who is also tasked with breaking down these invisible barriers to make them closer, might suggest that they go on a hike the next day to her favorite spot out at Bear Creek Overlook. She wants him to see that because not only does the activity of hiking introduce common ground, but the idea of sharing this scenic view that has moved you emotionally might do the same for the other person in question. You're inviting a shared experience that will both bring you physically and emotionally closer to one another. That process, of course, is called bonding. It can be perfectly innocent, of course, but it follows the same ritual involved in romantic courtship, which also makes it dangerous in certain situations. And for that reason, we don't normally take a scenic walk through nature with another man's wife or someone else's boyfriend and prefer to indulge such activities in a group setting. So at some point, either one of these people suggests going out to Bear Creek Overlook as a group, but we know by default of Carl's health that he'll be unable to join them on the hike. However, Donna can still make the trek. Yet when the next morning arrives, Donna has a hangover and declines to make the trip, while Jim and Barbara are still committed to making it happen. So what we see here, while it may seem insignificant on the surface, is an unintentional moment of bonding, or at least perceived moment of bonding, by way of commonality, in which both Jim and Barbara have partners who are either unable or unwilling to indulge their passions. And for that reason, these two have been brought together. What it means is that they have now ditched their partners for each other, even if it is only to go hiking. And from a symbolic standpoint, this hike is going to be a journey Barbara takes Jim on, one that ends with the two of them realizing something very beautiful lies ahead of them at the culmination of it. And again, on the surface, it's just a walk in the woods, but our minds are predisposed to projecting the future in a hopeful way that redefines our relationships and identity in a manner we find more favorable. It's why we have daydreams and fantasies as unrealistic as any of them might ever prove to be. Our minds are completely obsessed with possibility, and they've been built that way because our primary purpose is our evolution. So, I think there was some drinking and flirting going on at dinner, and Jim might have misconstrued the hiking suggestion as one in which Barbara chose an activity she knew her husband couldn't indulge. Carl was older and physically inhibited due to his heart attack, especially in relation to Jim, who was capable of making the hike and being a part of Barbara's passion. And by morning, when Donna opted out of going along for the hike, and Barbara still insisted on going, Jim saw this perhaps as an opportunity for him to get closer to her when they were alone. He could make his move. And again, it's all speculation, but let's take a look. Now, let's put Jim and Barbara in the car together. It's about a 10-mile drive that is said to be about 10 to 15 minutes, given that there's not a lot of traffic in this region. Okay, so they're together and alone, and will not be suspected of doing anything other than going on the hike if they're back in a few hours. However, if they commit to the hike and complete it, then there will be no time beyond that window in which they're able to be alone together, as their partners will expect them to arrive back at the house. It's not really a situation in which they could find an excuse to be gone longer than advertised. They're partaking in an activity that Barbara has done many times, which is the drive, hike to Bear Creek Overlook, and return drive. What it means is that, if Jim has intentions contrary to their stated activity, he will need to reveal those intentions to Barbara prior to arriving at the trail and starting the hike. But here's the bigger problem. For all of the times that men might have women flirt with them and become convinced that there's true intention behind the teasing that is going to lead to something, quite often, they're wrong. It's the thing that makes a lot of men so afraid of rejection, specifically the reality that you never really know the truth until you communicate your intentions directly and explicitly. Only then do you actually have the answer. And that involves risk. And of course, the answer is not always a good one. Sometimes it's a no. Sometimes it's shocking, as though you couldn't believe you were wrong. But you were. However, in truth, there's really not usually a whole lot at stake. You never know until you try, so you have to be confident and make your move. Where that advice can go terribly wrong, though, is in a situation in which the recipient of your advance is in a committed relationship that you already knew about, and vice versa. In this scenario, if Jim makes a move, it could go wrong in a way that could cost him dearly. There is definitely something to lose. Now let's quickly revisit the psychology of Barbara's disappearance as told by Jim. He was with her on the way out there, but not on the way back because, on the way back, she tried to go on without him and then suddenly disappeared. He has her wandering off without him, and while he's not looking or in contact with her or even facing her, she disappears absent his involvement. Sociopathic projections are often mirrored in construction, and that's done as a means of projecting a polar opposite emotional truth in relation to what actually occurred. So let's reverse those values and see what we get. When we do that, what we see is that Barbara didn't go on ahead without Jim. She went with him. And rather than leaving absent his involvement and in his ignorance without communication, she left by way of his will while communicating. He says she disappeared while alone and didn't see where she went, so we'll reverse that then and say that she disappeared with him and he knows where she went. Now, why would something like that occur in this case? Well, I think what transpired is that Jim and Barbara got into Jim's rental car and headed out on the road. And at some point during this journey to the trail, Jim revealed intentions that were likely sexual in nature and propositioned Barbara, and it happened as a result of him misunderstanding her intentions when they might have flirted during drinks and dinner the night before, and also the next morning when she expressed a desire to be alone with him on the hike after Donna declined. It seems as though he might have been convinced she was interested and took the gamble by propositioning her on the ride to the trail, and perhaps by way of suggesting they get a hotel room or something similar. I think she likely got offended and perhaps even scared and demanded that he pull over somewhere to allow her to get out of the car. At that point, Jim would realize this was a huge mistake and plead with her to not tell her husband or his girlfriend. I think Barbara probably refused to comply and attempted to leave the vehicle when he pulled over, intent upon revealing Jim's intentions when she got back. I believe he might have tried to stop her, even if just by grabbing an arm in an effort to continue to plead with her, and at that point, a struggle ensued, escalating the situation into violence, at which point Jim had unintentionally gone so far he couldn't go back. He might have chosen to silence her at this point, and with the event happening so early in the day, he would still have the option to dispose of her and go to the hiking trail to legitimize a false narrative about her disappearance. Yes, Barbara had a .357 Magnum in her backpack, but even her husband knew the folly of placing it in there, as he had told her many times that she wouldn't have time to retrieve it if confronted by a predator. I mean, gun holsters exist for a reason. If you're using a gun for the purpose of self-defense, its effectiveness will diminish when not kept at an arm's length. A question often arises about where Jim would have disposed of Barbara's body if he was, in fact, guilty of a criminal act resulting in her death. Would he have been capable of hiding it in a place where it would have gone undiscovered for such a long period of time? The answer is yes. We like to think the process of hiding a body is one that is very difficult to achieve effectively, but while there are countless stories of well-hidden corpses coming to light for various reasons, there are also many that don't, and it isn't because the perpetrators failed to go to the greatest extent of effort to hide them or get creative in a way that would never be suspected. On many occasions, bodies are simply dumped somewhere and go undetected, and we obviously don't hear about it because they're never found. Even if a killer simply put a trash bag containing a body in a dumpster, there's a good chance it gets collected with the rest of the rotting trash, heads straight to the dump, and is subsequently buried in a gigantic heap from which it will never emerge. I think it's quite possible that if the police took the initiative to try to track Jim's movements during the morning hours of that fateful day, they might have uncovered security footage in various places and at times that contradicted his stated timeline of going to the hiking trail with Barbara. Were there CCTV cameras either inside or outside local businesses that might have captured his image or his moving car, placing him elsewhere? Of course, that might have been a strong possibility. But they didn't investigate that angle, at least not to my knowledge. They said they wanted to find the young men from the hiking trail to confirm if they had actually seen and spoken to Jim and Barbara up there. But conversely, they could have simply investigated the driving route to the trail and also within the surrounding areas for evidence that Jim went somewhere else first. So, if I had to guess, Barbara's disappearance was the result of a failed romantic advance that would have had severe consequences for Jim, and while he likely had no intentions whatsoever to murder Barbara, it came to bear as a result of a struggle that ensued when he unsuccessfully tried to reason with her and stop her from revealing the truth about what he'd done. In terms of the cause of death, I think it lies in a physically manifested version of what he wanted emotionally. He wanted her to stay quiet, so I think he probably strangled her, which would also negate a bloody crime scene. The strangulation also speaks to a physical punishment equivalent to what the perpetrator feels was wrongly done to him in terms of disunity between body and mind. When we want something emotionally in our minds and take physical actions to complement that idea in an attempt to manifest the two as a unified reality, and it fails, the act of strangulation at the neck literally cuts off the connection between body and mind to make the victim suffer and fail physically at what the killer had already suffered emotionally. The victim is physically unable to link body and mind afterward, leading to a physical death that mirrors the emotional one the perpetrator endured in terms of their desires. Of course, there is no proof Jim did such a thing, and this should definitely be considered speculation at best. However, I don't think it's a coincidence that in the aftermath of this crime, Carl cut off communication with Jim and Donna, and later lamented that he wished the police had looked further into Jim from the start. I would definitely concur with that statement. I think it was a terrible mistake that law enforcement took Jim's word at face value. They say he was cooperative and even offered to take a polygraph, but the truth is they didn't press him hard enough for him to need to be uncooperative and also didn't accept that offer to undergo a polygraph. In my opinion, their fatal error here was not processing the rental car for the presence of physical evidence. Instead, they followed Jim's lead, scouring a place where it seemed Barbara had not even arrived, and they found nothing. Given the absence of proof that Barbara ever made it to the hiking trail that day, and even if she did, Jim was the last person to see her alive before she disappeared under incredibly mysterious circumstances that are nearly inexplicable. Authorities had been hopeful that they could locate the two young men Jim claimed had seen Barbara with him at the Overlook that day and even talked to her, but that opportunity has always eluded them. If Barbara had been on the trail that day, whether she succumbed to an animal attack, suicide, accident, or even a health event such as a heart attack, we likely would have some shred of evidence to substantiate her presence. But we don't. The dogs didn't detect her. Aerial and ground searches didn't reveal so much as a thread of her clothing. Her backpack was never discovered. And if by some strange means she ran off to start a new life, she took nothing with her, not a single resource, including money. People examining this case often wonder why Jim would offer the two young men with the dog as witnesses to Barbara being on the hiking trail that day at the Bear Creek Overlook, when it could easily be disproven if those men were found. They would obviously know if they had conversed with her, or if Jim was alone, and would be able to help the police catch Jim in a lie. But here's the truth. We don't actually know if Jim saw those guys on the trail that day. By the time Jim had talked to the police, he had already spoken to the construction crew when he asked them if they had seen Barbara. They might have just told him about the two young guys being the only people they saw. And even so, if the police did find them and they refuted Jim's story, Jim could easily just say it was two other guys. He'd have nothing to lose by lying. Even if the police didn't believe him, he wouldn't have incriminated himself with evidence. Taking a polygraph and appearing to be deceptive wouldn't have incriminated the man either. It should have been obvious to law enforcement that when their extensive searches revealed no sign of Barbara on the trail or in the surrounding area, that they needed to take a look at what transpired prior to the hiking partners arriving at the trail that day. There doesn't seem to have been much scrutiny in that regard, and I think it's likely why this case remains unsolved. So, at the end of this tale, I think the part that really resonated with me was the sleepless nights and lack of closure Carl Bullock must have endured in the aftermath of Barbara's disappearance. I wondered what became of him, and in searching for this information, I learned from his obituary that Carl passed away in 2021 as a result of pancreatic cancer, never knowing Barbara's fate. I read through his family history, detailing his early days of service in the Air Force to his retirement from his career in the banking industry. And at that point, the narrative transitions into his move back to the Bitterroot Valley, at which point I was sure the obituary was going to mention his marriage to Barbara. But it doesn't. It skips right over that chapter to a time in 2013 when Carl got remarried and found happiness and love with another woman, which I think is a wonderful thing given what he must have suffered. At the same time, however, as I kept reading and reached the end of the document, and subsequently the end of Carl's life, I couldn't help but feel this overwhelming sadness for Barbara Bullock. There was no mention of her, as though she never even existed at all. She had simply vanished from the timeline, as she had from his life, and from this earth, one way or another. Maybe her absence from the obituary was out of respect to her unknown fate. Maybe it was too personal or private to revisit. Or maybe somebody wanted to forget. But regardless of the truth, Barbara Bullock was silenced once again. And while this is just an observation and not a judgment, the profound irony of her disappearance from the summary of Carl's life seems like a cruel fate, and yet, at the same token, also seems fair because, in essence, it's true. She did vanish from his life. She is still nowhere to be found. She's missing. And so, perhaps what she's owed in this case isn't acknowledgement, nor is it remembrance. It's the truth. And it starts with a question, one we must continue to ask in order to finally get an answer. Where is Barbara Bullock?